Hey guys, and welcome back to another edition of the Wrestling Stoop with the legend himself, Bob Roop. And I'm your co-host, Ray Russell, once again along for the fun ride that is the Wrestling Stoop, as this week's episode is going to take us on a very unique and scary ride back to January, February of 1972 and Bob's trip to the country of Iraq, where he wrestled for promoter Saddam Hussein. You heard me right, guys. We're going to hear about, once again, his unique and at the same time, very, well, I'll call it downright terrifying experiences while he was there. But before we get to that, just a quick reminder that you guys can listen to The Wrestling Stoop with Bob Roop and sister shows like The Wrestling Memory Grenade, currently covering the 1988 and the WWF Project. Also, the Regional Wrestling Podcast, where we talk the territories. Three projects going on right now at Regional Wrestling. It's Georgia 1981, the UWF in 1986, and Memphis in 1985. All going on right now at Regional Wrestling. You can also listen to Bob's buddy, Barry Rose, and his partner, Captain Nick Massey, on the Glory Days Grapple Concast. You get all the latest news. Everybody headed to the Glory Days Grapple Con, Orlando, Florida, April the 20th. At the fabulous Rosen Center Hotel. Lots of great guest interviews on the Glory Days Grapple Concast, Jack Victory being the most recent. And hey, how about this? Coming at the beginning of April, it's the Puro Wrestling Academy podcast with the professor of Puro Resu himself, Mr. Dan Ginnity. Be sure to join that program as class is in session each and every week. Dan, going to school us on the history of Japanese professional wrestling in the English language. And you can listen to all of those shows and more, all part of the WrestleCopia podcast network located over at WrestleCopia.com. That's WrestleCopia.com and anywhere your podcast streaming needs are met, from Apple to Spotify, Pocket Cast, and beyond. And be sure to follow me on social media, guys, for all the latest goings on here at the WrestleCopia podcast network. You can friend Bob on Facebook. Find him there at Facebook.com/PoorBobRoop. And you can follow me, Ray Russell, on X, formerly Twitter, at Wrestling Grenade. That's at RASSLIN Grenade. Follow and like me, Facebook.com/Wrestling Grenade, and subscribe to YouTube.com/Wrestling Grenade. And last but most definitely not least, now would be a fantabulous time to become a WrestleCopia patron. Talking about that $5 all access tier over at Patreon.com/WrestleCopia. That address again, Patreon.com/WrestleCopia. Where you get so many gifts for just $5, including my insanely detailed show notes for every episode of The Grenade, Regional Wrestling, and the Monday Warfare podcast. You'll also get early access to many of the podcasts here on WrestleCopia, where you can listen days and sometimes as much as a week earlier than the rest of the listeners. Then from there, it's remastered versions of the earliest episodes of The Grenade Show, covering the 1989 NWA project, includes enhanced sound quality, plus new content and conversation never heard before. But that's still not all. You also get digital downloads for your viewing and reading pleasure, random bonus video drops, and of course, the Patreon-exclusive Watch Along series, covering many past WWF and WCW events. And you get all of that, and so much more, for just $5. No subscription, cancel anytime. Give it a try for a month. I think you'll like all of the content that I offer, and every penny of it goes right back here into supporting the brand to help keep the WrestleCopia podcast network and all of the great shows here up and running for the months and the years to come. And now with all of that out of the way, time to bring the man back onto the show. Welcome back, Bob Roop.
Thanks, Ray. It's good to be back with you, my friend. Oh, it's always look forward to this every week.
Oh, me too. Me too, Bob. In fact, earlier today, my son Connor, he likes to binge watch old wrestling. He'll go back and watch A Year of Crockett, A Year of Dallas, this or that or the other. And today he went back and went to the beginning of what is available on the Peacock network of Mid-South. And wouldn't you know it, Bob Roop right there on the TV screen earlier today.
Wow. Well, you know, if I ever come visit you and walk in your son, if he's waiting for Bob Roop to walk in, I used to visit classrooms all the time, when the people who invited me always had a picture of me in my wrestling days.
Right.
So when I walked in, I'd walk in the classroom and say, well, here's Bob Roop. Well, all the kids would look at me, and then they'd look at the door. They were expecting someone else to walk,
walk
in.
Behind you, yeah.
Oh, Bob Roop's grandfather walked in first.
Yeah.
Oh, where's Bob? So, yeah, well, you know, once I open my mouth, usually it comes pretty clear. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's him.
That is Bob. Damn.
That's the heel. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Bob, we've had a lot of fun the last few weeks. We remembered the life and times of Ole Anderson. We've talked to, you know, Black History Month. We delved into your time in Amarillo and the Funks. It's time to apologize once again this week, Bob, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I apologize to the Funks. Yeah. You know, a couple of mistakes, too. One of them was when I talked about investing, myself, Jerry and Jack Briscoe and Eddie Graham.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Investing. I somehow said 25,000 each. It was the total we invested was 25. It was 5,000 each.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want Jerry to, you know, Jerry's still around and he was part of that deal. I want to say, well, and Bob's lost it. So that was one. Another one was when I first got the call, we were talking about Tony Atlas. And I said, the first call I got was from Bill Watts. It wasn't, it was from Ernie. Now later on, I only made one reference to Bill. And from then on, I said, yeah, Ernie was the one that called and said, Bob, right. you give him 8 weeks. And after that, I don't care what he's doing, how great he looks, what he says, what he looks like, he's going to go off and he's going to come unglued. So give him eight weeks.
I love that you go back and listen to everything and clarify things. I got to tell you, after listening to those, I do remember both of those instances you're referring to. But I appreciate, and I'm sure everybody out there appreciates you, you know, recalling and fixing these basically verbal typos, if you will. Simple errors, no big deal. But as you told those stories, it was pretty obvious what you meant. So no harm, no foul, but we certainly appreciate it. You know, just keeping everything on the level.
Well, you also do a great job of editing. I think you had out about 15 you knows or per hour. I'm not used to doing these interviews, even when in my wrestling days. I mean, we didn't interview for hours every week.
Right.
You know, if you did 10 minutes, it was a lot. So, and I'm not a public speaker per se. I mean, I can. I'm fairly comfortable. But yeah, well, this is
with all
good
those
stuff.
You knows, I just thought you were imitating Tommy Rich. I thought it was a great Tommy Rich impression. You know,
boy, did I turn you on to that? Because
I just heard a Tommy Rich promo or two. That's all. You know.
Oh,
you know?
Man, so. when I was the one running the promos for Ole and Tommy. Oh, geez. I mean, you had 30 seconds to get, you know, the name of the place and who he was wrestling and what the stakes were. The guy beat up your mother or whatever. And he sometimes, with all the you knows he'd throw in there, he wouldn't get but one or two of those out. So anyway, bless Tommy. I saw him last year at Waterloo, and I'm glad he's doing well and still hanging in there.
Well, Bob, this week I'm going to steal a page out of Tommy Rich's vocabulary here, and I'm going to say, somebody say something about Iraq, because that's what the topic is here this week. On the show, we're going to talk about when you go back in 1972, you briefly returned to the Florida territory after your time in Amarillo. Sorry again, Funk family. But here we are, you're back in Florida and you're not here very long before you go off to work. Adnan LKC, AKA Sheik Adnan, General Adnan in the WWF later on, Billy White Wolf during his peak days as well as the Native American character. But here it is, 1972, and you're going to be heading off to Iraq of all places. And I want you to take everybody back to that time frame. I don't know if you recall, because I know you've done some interviews on this in the past and you've talked about writing a book and working your work in progress, as you put it, and re-releasing that particular book. But I'm just curious how it got started. Who came to you? Do you remember how it all got put together? You being offered the spot to head over to Iraq?
Yes, I do. Before I was working in Florida, and I think Eddie Graham, I was doing, maybe it was for TV. Anyway, Eddie was there, I was there, and he told me that Sam Muchnick wanted me to call him. And, you know, that Sam was the president and all that. And I knew him briefly from, you know, an hour or half hour or so interview to help me get started, you know, from a couple of years before.
Uh-huh.
But so I called Sam, and he said he had gotten a call from a promoter in England who was trying to book someone to go to Iraq.
Okay.
And he heard that I like to travel. And so here's the import of it coming from Sam. the fact that it came from Sam, just in my mind, automatically, you know, this guy is, even though it's a kind of a de facto position, I mean, it's just it's more not in reality, the president of the NWA doesn't really do anything, but say he's the president of the NWA. But the fact that he had the position and his stature, and he had his own stature as a newspaper man, you know, I was in his office. He had all sorts of awards and everything. He was a man of substance, let's put it that way. He wasn't an empty suit. So the fact that he was, he spoke up for Rawisco gave Rawisco credit to me.
Now, Rawisco, he was a European promoter, right?
British? He was in England, yes. He lived in Leeds, England. He was part of a joint, it was called Joint Promotions, as a matter of fact. At one time, his father owned all the promotional rights to all of England, Scotland, Ireland. He owned all of it. But like so many sons of very powerful men, well, after his father passed away, he left everything to George. But see, it's not, there's no deeds, there's no titles, there's no property rights to any of those things. They're up for grabs. And within a couple of years, all George had that he was, the other promoters and joint promotions allowed all the local promoters all of a sudden, instead of just running the town for Rawisco Sr. or George Rawisco, I think his father's name was George also, instead of running the town for them, all of a sudden now it was their town. They were running it for themselves.
Uh-huh.
And George ended up with Leeds and Manchester, which wasn't that far away, Manchester was a big town, and Scotland. So when I talked to George, he talked about coming to Iraq, and I didn't ask him if it was dangerous over there. Yeah, you would have thought he would have told me, but, you know, if he had, I wouldn't have gone, of course. But it sounded like an adventure to me. I've said on former programs that I wanted to travel. I've never been to the Middle East or even through there. You haven't even flown through there, like to Cairo or, you know, any place like that. So, you know, I thought it'd be great. I thought it'd be an adventure. So I agreed to go. Now, I don't want to confuse anybody, but this turned out to be a very serious mistake. My life was at risk. I was in the country for about 15 days, and my life was at risk directly on three of those days. I mean, threat was right there. I had to duck and dodge to get away from it. And in reality, all the time, because even on my day of being greeted by the governor of Baghdad, the second place they showed me was a torture chamber. And wow. I had me walk inside, not to, you know, you don't sense, you don't put somebody inside of a torture chamber. It's not like all the people being tortured are going to sing a song for you or something. The people in there are still being tortured. Some of them are screaming. In fact, they tortured some people right in front of me. Wow. So that sort of gave me a hint that maybe not everything's looking real good here.
I would have already been back on a plane after that. Not that you had much of an option.
No, that was not an option. They were going to have to, there was no plane available for me until the powers that be said there would.
Mm-hmm.
But I found out later, and what I'm going to do is I want to go back to about Sam and why this happened, because it was just an accident. Sam had a Wild Bill Longson. Did I say that right? Longson.
Bill Longson, yeah.
Bill Longson was a former, the way he was introduced to me, was a former NWA world champion. Yeah,
right.
So,
yeah.
I mean, he was an older guy. Clearly, he was retired and everything, but Sam introduced me to him. So the guy automatically had status with me. And Bill, or Wild Bill, I almost called him Mr. Longson. I mean, he was older than me, but, you know, he was one of the boys. But one time, the second time I went to work there, he picked me up at the airport. Now, this is all before I went to Baghdad.
Right.
He picked me up at the airport and was taking me to Sam's office or to the building. You know, he's kind of quiet, and I, you know, he was a veteran. I was feeling very inadequate, his presence, foreign champion, and all that. So the only thing I had on my resume that had any kind of import at all was the match in Seoul, Korea, the one I talked about on a former program about the, you know, 15,000 people.
Were you teamed with Lars?
Yeah, my team was Lars. Right. Had the 15,000 people going nuts and 10,000 waiting out in the parking lot, way past curfew, 5-6 hours. Well, I thought, you know, for me at that time, that was like a seminal moment. That was like my high spot. That was my high point. For one thing, was the 15,000 people. You know, that's a respectable audience. Now, maybe not in St. Louis. I don't know. So anyway, I trotted out that story, and I tried to make it kind of like it was just a no big deal. You know, like, yeah, just another night, another day at the office, where it wasn't that at all. It was my only day at the office in terms of like hard times. But what happened was that Blogson apparently passed on to Sam Muchnick. The way I see it is that Sam got the call from Ralph Wisco, and he was saying, yeah, maybe Longston heard him on the phone. Well, Sam said, well, I can look for somebody. And they talked it over, and Longston told him, and this is what I found later from Sam, this is what happened, that Longston told him that, well, call Bob Roop. When I brought him in the last time he was here, he was talking about being in a riot in Korea and liking it. He thought it was like an adventure. So, yeah, he likes
bring in this idiot.
Yeah,
he'll do anything.
Yeah, because even Sam probably knew that Iraq was risky business. I mean, sure. I don't know why he wouldn't. Afterwards, in the next 6 months after Rustin, or like a year after Rustin in Iraq, I was in England, and when I ran into some of the boys at the shows, they say, oh, Roop, yeah, you're the guy that went to Iraq, right? I say, yeah. So, well, you know, what's your problem? I found out just tonight from you, your great historian that you are, that I thought I was the third wrestler there. It looks like I was more like the fifth, which is fine.
Yeah, somewhere around there. We'll run down the names real quick for anybody interested. Now, this could, you know, this is just the list I compiled over time of doing research. There may be more in here. There, you know, I'm not really sure, but these are the ones I could, you know, guarantee that absolutely worked over. Some of these videos, the footage of some of these matches actually exist, which is really unfortunate. You know, there's so little of yours out there.
Right.
Meanwhile, you can watch, you know, the likes of Ian Campbell wrestle right. Adnan for an hour, which, you know, yep. probably wasn't as exciting. But we'll go back late 60s, probably around 69 or so, I'd say. Former Mr. Universe bodybuilder John Lees of Manchester, England. He was the first one I could find against Adnan over there. Then Adnan did two matches with Ian Campbell in 1970, the first of which back in March 19th, in Karbala. Hopefully I pronounced that right. And then they had a rematch later on in Baghdad, with Adnan going over. He also wrestles Canadian George Gordienko in 1971. Now, there's also a British guy by the name of Danny Lynch who worked Adnan over there, but I couldn't get a date. I have the newspaper clipping, but I can't read what it says on it. So I was unable to really determine the year of that. But it seemed like it may have been after you, Bob. But obviously, the big story, the big news, the one you know and can confirm and you've heard about, and I think you even said you spoke to Andre briefly about it, it was Andre the Giant, then at the time, as you said, Monster Rusamov, still hadn't quite got the Andre name yet.
No.
So I don't know if you want to talk about any of that. I don't know if you've ever come in contact with any of these guys besides Andre, but anything you have to tell before we get to your story about Andre or anyone else, feel free to give everybody kind of an idea of what you were walking into.
Okay. Of those, of that group, all of those, not Andre, but the Canadian and the Englishman, and Ian Campbell was Scotsman, I guess. They're all part of the British Commonwealth, and they were all Commonwealth wrestlers. So George Gordienko, although a Canadian, he was Commonwealth champion. I'm not sure if he was champion when he went over there. He might have been, but I don't think if he was, I don't think the belt was up that was being contested. I think they made a belt of something representing the Middle East type kind of belt that they fought for. But what happened with George Gordienko? George Gordienko was a great wrestler. I give you just a couple of high spots. When he wrestled in Canada, he went 90 minutes with Lou Thesz and threw it to a draw. And Thesz called him one of the best wrestlers he'd ever been against. And he was a shooter, great worker, but he was a shooter. And he got into some kind of beef where, through his romantic life, he had an ex do something that got him where he couldn't get a license to wrestle in the United States. So he had to wrestle in Europe and England. He would take, you know, he would take work where he could get it. So he wrestled all over the Middle East. Well, I read his story, and also his nephew, Ted Gordienko, and I became friends. I never got to meet George. I really wish I could have, because he sounds like a really stand-up guy. I think we haven't had an amateur background, or at least know how to hook. I think we would have had some things in common. I believe there would have been enough mutual respect that we would have, and things in common plus mutual respect that we could have gotten along. He would have been a good friend, because I sure admired what he did. I remember seeing a picture of him standing there, there with a bear that was about 6 inches taller than him. And the bear's claws, one of his big forearms was up on George's shoulder like a tie-up, and he had like 4-inch claws coming out of that paw. Wow. And all the American, you know, all the American trained bears are declawed. You know, sure. Nobody go in the ring with
for
them
good reason. Yeah,
boy, yeah, I guess they could disembowel you, you know, just while they're scratching their nose. Anyway, George was a George wrestled. He wrestled two wrestlers before me. Andre was the one a year ahead of mine, and George was about a year and a half ahead of Andre. These matches didn't happen every month. There was at least a year, sometimes a year and a half, or even, let's say a year and a half might be the normal time between matches. But when George wrestled, he and Adnan were supposed to split falls. Adnan was going to take the first fall, and then George was going to do some kind of heel move and take the second fall. And I'm not sure what they were going to do in the final fall, because it didn't matter. What happened was that George Gordienko, when he went over there, he was a very, very seasoned wrestler, wrestled all over the world, except the United States, obviously. So in the first fall, when Casey won the fall, they had a riot. Now, it wasn't a riot out of people being mad. It was a riot of joy, of exultation, that their champion had beaten this great European Commonwealth champion. And they had a riot, and by the time they got it done, they were carrying bodies out of there, including, Chad said that George's got the pass to him, but at least two or three of the people he knew were dead. You could see it, they were. And they're carrying him out of there. And that was with Adnan winning the fall.
Right.
So in between, and there was usually a like 5-minute break between falls. George told the referee to tell Adnan to take it in two straights. There was no way he was going to take a fall on the guy. It was too dangerous. So Adnan beat him two straight, and they went berserk again. And at the end of the night, when all the fatalities were six people dead. I don't know how many injured. It had to be hundreds, maybe more. But for George to even get out of there, what happened was when Adnan won the second fall and won the match, everybody went crazy. All the soldiers, always soldiers around the ring with submachine guns, AK-47s, and like 500-600 of them. They are protecting the dignitaries, the governor of Baghdad, and any foreign guests are all sitting within a circle formed by these military special security troops that are make a big circle around the ring that maybe, 25, 30 feet away from ringside. And they tried to keep all the people.
So they were essentially the guardrail.
Yeah, they were supposed to be. It never worked, but they were supposed to be.
Gotcha.
And, well, there's another factor, too. There were television cameras on all corners of the ring. And when fans are jostling around for position, it's real easy for somebody to brush up into the support stand for those TV cameras. And they're not built in concrete or anything. They're movable. So if you knock over one of the cameras, you know, that's a serious problem. But in order for Gordienko to get out of there, first of all, the gunfire went off. There was so much smoke in the air, he couldn't see anything. So he dropped down onto the mat because he wasn't sure that the people shooting the guns could see him if he was up there where all the smoke was blowing through there. So he got down at mat level, and in order for him to get out of there, they had a hard time getting Casey out of there. And Casey's attitude about it was, every man for himself. You know, I don't care if I brought you here. You want to get out and figure out some way to do it. They had to back a truck, a special security truck, up to the ring and kind of shuffle George into it and take him out of there and drove him all the way back into Baghdad somewhere. You know, obviously, I didn't know any of that before I went there. So that was the kind of atmosphere that you had. So let's go back to me accepting the match. I'm told like at a certain date, I fly to Heathrow Airport in London. Rawisco, his wife, and a referee, and my second are there to meet me. And we stayed overnight there, and the next day we flew to Baghdad, and we stopped three or four places on the way, three or four stops on the way. We got into Baghdad, and now on the way, one place we had a stopover for like an hour and a half, and in England, in London, night before we had dinner, before we all went to a room and slept for the night, they were very friendly, effusive, and I thought, well, it's going to be great. I'm going to be in these people's company for 2 weeks. And so it's nice to know that we'll get along and everything. Well, as soon as we started our flight, they cooled off. And by the time we got to the first stopover, layover, where we had a couple of hours trying to get engaged in anybody just in conversation, they would talk among themselves. But I couldn't get anybody to. I'd ask them questions about themselves. They only have, that usually can get anybody interested in talking to you, and they're talking about themselves, and they would just give me one or two word answers, and it was clear, they didn't want to talk to me. So that was kind of hard to figure out. I didn't figure it out till later. Anyway, we got to Baghdad, and we're going through customs, and I looked, and the customs area was, we were the only plane that was in there. I thought, well, that's great. We're going to get through customs really quick. So we're going through, and Rawisco and his wife, and Steve Haggerty was the name of the second, and the referee's name was George Wade. George Rawisco's wife's name was Elsie. And they're ahead of me. I'm not far, but I'm trailing behind them. And as they go through, this guy in a uniform steps in front of me and blocks my way. I mean, he makes, if I'm going to keep going, I'm going to walk right over the front of him. And he points off to his right to a place that's about, say, a place that Rawisco and his group are going, and the rest of the passengers are going. Say that's at 12 o'clock. He's directed me a place about 10 o'clock. There was a lonely little shack over there, a custom shack, with a couple guys waiting over there. He said, you go there. And I looked to Rawisco and his wife, and I looked for them for some kind of a, fill me in what's going on here. Why am I being singled out like this? They all had their backs turned to me. So this guy that was telling me, this guy in the uniform, who was telling me, he acted like he was going to put his hands on me because I didn't do what he said right away. And he said, hey, you go there. And he was like yelling at me. And I said, hey, you go F yourself. And wow. Because
it's pretty ballsy. I did.
I'm coming there. First of all, they can't have a match without me. So I come there as a so-called honored guest. And I've been into foreign countries a bunch of times. I've been in Japan, Australia, New Zealand, a bunch of different places. I've never had anybody act anyway close to that. So I thought the guy was drunk or high or something, stupid anyway. So he couldn't believe it. When I talked back to him, it's like he was astonished. Because you just didn't do that there, which I found out later. Well, anyway, if I was going to get my passport stamped, I was going to have to go to this place at 10 o'clock. So, a position, and I know about 50, 60 feet in front of me. So I went down there, and these two guys down there are waiting. And they take my passport. Don't say hello, anything. They're looking at my passport. One guy says, stay here. And they both went in the shack. So I'm standing out there where I can't, it's got a window, but I can't see in it from where I'm standing. And so I wait out there, I don't know, a minute or two. And then I decided to go and see what was going on. And I go and I look through the window, and they're looking at my passport. I assume it was my passport. Well, and it had a magnifying glass in their hand. And they're looking at the cover and inside. So I yelled through the window, I said, hey, you looking for my name? Look for the picture. My name's right under the picture, if that's what you're looking for. And they didn't appreciate that at all. They came back out, and they're giving me a hard time and all that. And they say, well, the guy started putting my passport in his pocket. I said, hey, buddy, you can't do that. That's not my property. You can't take it. And they both beamed up at that. They said, what do you mean we can't take it? It doesn't belong to you? I said, well, it's in my name. It belongs to my country, the United States of America. Uh-huh. It's their property. So you're stealing from both of us, me and them. Well, he just said, forget the United States of America. You're in our country now. You will abide by our laws. The guy stuck it in his coat pocket. And they turned around. They walked about 10 feet away, went through a door, and shut the door behind them. Well, what was I going to do? I mean, go after them. Both of them had guns they had uniforms. They had pistols at their waist. Yeah, they were also officials. You're in our country now. You will abide or obey our laws. So I went on back over to, I caught up, you know, Westco and them were only, I don't know, 30, 40 feet away. I went over and explained. I said, well, what the hell's going on? They took my passport. They can't do that. It's against international law. And Elsie said, Bob, in Iraq, the law is whatever the Ba'ath party that's in. That was the name of the political party that was in power at the time. And they said the Ba'ath party makes the rules, and, you know, your only option is to obey them. I got Orozco aside. I didn't want to cuss him out in front of everybody, so I got him aside, grabbed him by, I took him by the elbow of his coat. I said, come with me, George. And I got my back to them where I was hiding him, where they couldn't see him and they couldn't see me, or they couldn't see one of us talking. And I said, George, why didn't you tell me about this crap? I didn't know this was going to happen. I said, really? I said, you never had anything like this happen before? Well, no, we haven't had anything. I said, well, you didn't think that, to warn me. Do you remember when you first called me, if I asked you if it was safe over here? He said, well, I think I remember. George, I'm not feeling real safe at the moment. I haven't been in the country 5 minutes. They've already stolen my passport.
Yeah.
So about that time, Miss Elsie came over, and that was her job. She was his, I called her his social babysitter. She would always come in and get him out of difficult situations where his big mouth or his gauche behavior got him into. She would come and try to rescue him, but just by getting him out of there. Oh, George, I'm not feeling well. George, come and help me take my medicine or something like that. So anyway, we were just stuck. We went from there. There was a waiting room, and the Rawiscos had some people wait. They'd been there several times before. They brought both George Gordienko. In fact, Rawisco probably bought all those guys. Ian Campbell.
That would make sense. I mean, outside of Gordienko being from Canada, the rest of them, I mean, they were from, you know, over in that area where he promoted England, like you said, Ian Campbell, I believe you said Scotland. And even Danny Lynch, whether he was before or after you, I don't know, but he too was from England. So it totally makes sense here. And then Andre from France.
Right. You know, I've got another link now. I just something from years ago came to me. Casey wrestled in England quite a bit. In mm-hmm. fact, he had a relationship going. I'm not sure they were engaged, but Rawister had a daughter named Anne, and they were hot and heavy for a while with him, Adnan Casey, and his daughter.
All right.
So if Adnan was wrestling in England, he would know all these guys. He would have known that. Did you say Johnny something? He would have known Ian Campbell. He definitely knew George Gordienko, because Adnan was an amateur wrestler. He wrestled. He left Iraq after high school and went to the United States, went to school at Oklahoma State, graduated. He wrestled the whole time he was there. I think he was an All-American. I think he was decent. And then he stayed in the country. He turned pro, became a pro wrestler. He was there for 15 years. He married an American woman, became an American citizen. And what happened to him, his mother got sick or passed away. I can't remember which. But he came back to Iraq, and he was a rare bird in Iraq. He was somebody who had left the country who had done well for himself. He was known as a wrestler. I'm not sure if it was from wrestling in the United Kingdom, or the English promoters if the TV came in there. But anyway. He was known, and they did a newspaper article about him. you know, local boy makes good sort of thing. And what happened is somebody in the government saw that, and they told Adnan that they wanted to make his visit home last a little bit longer, like maybe for the rest of his life, because he was shanghaied, you might say, to start having wrestling matches. He was a pro wrestler, so what better way to have a political rally than to have a pro wrestling match? They had a soccer stadium right there in Baghdad. It was only supposed to seat 40,000 people. So when I heard the figures that there were 200 or 250,000 people in there, I found it hard to believe, but it's not that hard when you think that 40,000 people sitting in there, none of them are sitting on each other's lap. A person takes up a lot less room if they're standing. And for most of the time that I saw, everybody in the stadium was on their feet. Just because if you wanted to see, you had to stand up. Casey was the one that trotted out those figures. Now, he might have bumped them up to make himself look good. I don't know.
Well, but, I said it last week, and I just want to, you know, for anybody who missed that last week, there's not a whole lot of footage out there of the situation you're talking about, Bob. But there's about 30 seconds of it, which is better than zero, I suppose, on YouTube for anybody that wants to look up this matchup between you and Adnan. Unfortunately, there's only about 10 seconds of the match, but the first 20 seconds is somebody simply filming this literal sea of human beings. It's scary. Like I told you last week, this happened 50 years ago, longer.
Yep.
And it's frightening today to look at.
Oh my God.
Just to vision having to actually be there and see this sea of people. Now, I've seen it reported realistically, they say it was probably more like 120,000 people. But I mean, if somebody told me that was 200,000 people, I'd totally buy it. You can't see anything but human beings for as, you know, far as your eyes can see. It's insane. There's no way half those people could even see what was happening here. But I guess they felt an obligation to be there either way. And I'm sure they came to see, you know, you get your butt whipped also. But yeah, it's just it's a scary thing. But I was going to tell you before you continue on here, why don't you tell everybody how big of a quote unquote star Adnan was here in Iraq after Saddam had conversations with him? I know they knew each other in like grade school or whatever it's called over there. They had actually went to school together growing up a little bit. I don't know how close of friends they were, but they did know each other. And so here he is. I had heard that they had given Adnan a mansion to live in. And I mean like, you know, one of those Palestine type mansions too. I don't mean like, you know, somebody here in the United States. I mean, some big giant glorious thing. So I don't know if you heard that story or not, but yeah, he was living large over there.
Yeah. After he beat Andre, or maybe it was Gordienko. They built, they didn't give him one. They built one for him.
Oh, wow.
They put a statue of him, life-size statue, out in front of it. And it was, I don't know, it wasn't solid gold, but I think it was gold covered, gilt, gold plating, that of him in a wrestling pose. He was captive. He was like a bird, you know, in a velvet cage.
It looked great on the outside. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Imagine how bad things had to be, you know, inside his own mind to get the hell out of here, that you would give all of that up. You know, things look good. Rose-colored glasses from the outside looking in anyway.
Well, one of the things he said that was when he met with Saddam, even the first time, and now, like you say, they knew each other from before, and Casey had come a long way in his area, but Saddam had come a heck of a lot further in his area. He was He was probably the most powerful man in the country in terms of true power. He wasn't the president. He was the vice president. Mm-hmm. But he was head of security. He was in charge of all the armed forces. When he decided years later that he wanted to become the big chief, he just told the president of the country, it's time for you to retire. And he took over.
Yeah.
But Casey said that, or in his book, he wrote that when Saddam invited him to talk to him, or invited him, commanded him to do a command performance. One of the things he did, we waited until Adnan sat down, and he pulled his pistol out from his belt and put it on the table. Now, he didn't have it aiming at Adnan, but he had it on the table, which, I mean, that he didn't say anything comforting. Like, you know, it kind of pokes me when I'm sitting down, so I'm just going to sit over here. He just sat on the table the whole time looking at Adnan like, guess what way I want you to answer my questions here, Bozo? So he told Saddam was a politician, and he was very I hadn't, you had to bring it up first, which is fine. I didn't find out. I went from 1972 until 2015.
Okay.
Not knowing about Saddam Hussein. I turned on the TV one day and I just happened to come across a friend of mine, and I recognized Mike Mooneyham was mm-hmm. a wrestling writer for a newspaper in South Carolina and a great writer and good guy. He was inducted in Waterloo for his writing. I got to meet him and his wife down there. I liked them both a lot. Well, Mike's talking to Adnan, and Adnan's talking about, he says, yeah, what he told me was that I was getting ready to wrestle Andre the Giant, and on the way to the ring, Saddam stepped in front of me, and he pulled his coat aside. He said, be victorious, Adnan, be victorious. This guy's big, but he's pussy. I know you can beat him. If he hurts you at all, then he pulled his coat aside and showed Adnan, he pointed at his pistol. He says, if he hurts you at all, he said, I'm going to fill him full of holes and send him back to France in a box. That was a year before I got there. And that was right, like in a minute before, Casey went right from there. He took four or five steps and got up into the ring and started the match. And his match with Andre was supposed to take a fall.
Right.
Every match over there under Commonwealth rules was 2 out of 3 fall match.
Uh-huh.
1 hour time limit with 3 20-minute periods. So if you wrestled 20 minutes and nobody got a pin or disqualification or whatever, or submission, then that 20-minute period would be a draw.
Right.
And the rules were you had to win 2 out of 3 falls. Now, you could win by disqualification. You didn't have to pin the guy, but you had to win 2 out of 3 falls. And now the way to win was you pin the guy, of course, which would be like a 3 count. But also, like in boxing, if a guy went down and couldn't get up, and they counted to 10, that was the same thing as like he'd been pinned. Actually, even more impressive, because you can catch a guy who's, you know, in some kind of amateur hold that you had, that the guy still got his full strength, but you can hold him down for a 3 count, and he pops out after it's over. He gets up, and he's, you know, there's nothing wrong with him. He just got caught. If you can't get up by the count of 10, obviously there's something wrong with you. So your guy has actually, you know, made it much worse for you than just by catching in some hole. So anyway, Andre was supposed to take one of the falls in their match. And Casey, I always thought maybe he was afraid that Saddam might shoot at him while he was in the ring. He might get in the way of a bullet himself. So he told the referee, tell Andre that he wasn't going to be taking a fall, that Casey was going to beat him 2 straight falls.
Right.
And I think he did in about 5 or 6 minutes each fall. And the reason why is because Andre didn't know any amateur wrestling. All those English guys knew holds.
Sure.
And Adnan, having worked in Great Britain and with all those guys, had matches with them where they in and out of holds. That was the style there. So he was used to it. I had amateur wrestling in my background, quite different from the English way the professional holds. Our holds were more legitimate, but I mean, we weren't applying them legitimately, you know, with full force and all that, but we could look like we were shooting. I went 58 minutes with it. Andre went about 10 minutes, 5 minutes each fall, because Adnan was afraid that they would expose. There were a lot of people. Iraq has got a population with a lot of lower income in terms of socioeconomic status.
Mm-hmm.
People who are poor and are like lower, I don't want to say class, because they might be very classy people, but it's, in terms of their social status and their economic power, they're like low class. So, but there are all sorts of high class people, a lot of very educated people who were educated in the West and have seen Western style pro wrestling. So it wouldn't take 2 months to realize that what you're seeing out there, if Andre and Adnan were doing the same thing that they see in the West, from to realize that this wasn't a legitimate contest.
Right. My understanding, I don't know if I read this somewhere, if I heard Adnan say this, but I guess the initial plan was Adnan go over fall number 1 on disqualification. Andre goes over in fall number two to give him some kind of credibility. And then fall number three, Adnan makes the big heroic comeback and scores the win, wins two falls out of three. Obviously, you know, we talked, you just mentioned why they nixed that plan and went with the two straight falls for Adnan. Great storytelling here, the way it was supposed to go down, if it was happening, you know, in the United States, but happening in Iraq, it just wasn't meant to be. But what gets me the most out of all of this was the conversation that Saddam had with Adnan on the way to the ring. Not so much opening up his coat, showing off his what's been rumored to be a gold-plated pistol, and threatening to kill Andre should he even hurt Adnan in this match. But it's not so much that. It's that Saddam Hussein, I mean, he believes professional wrestling is real. He's a mark. It's unbelievable. Could you imagine being in Adnan's shoes and having to try to fucking work Saddam Hussein right under his nose, knowing well that at any moment, should he ever find out, you're done. Could you imagine think about that. Everybody out there who grew up during the Gulf War and knows even a little bit about Saddam Hussein and his history. Think about that for a minute. This guy believed professional wrestling was real, at least in the late 60s, early 70s. He did, at least until Adnan got the hell back out of Dodge. But just think about that for a minute. Being in Adnan's mind at any moment, Saddam, you know, it's crazy. That's insane that this guy, this leader of, you know, evil, believed pro wrestling was real. He was just another one of the marks.
Well, while I was there, or shortly before I got there, the president or one of the head honchos at a university in Baghdad had written an article in a student paper saying that the pro wrestling or the wrestling that Adnan was doing was prostitution on their great net. Because wrestling is very, very popular in the Middle East. Very popular. Iraq, Iran. Iran has always usually got Olympic champions. It did for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
And had a great team. So, that was prostituting. Well, the governor of Baghdad read the article. He sent goons out to the university, the same kind of guys that met me at the airport, and they dragged the guy through the streets of Baghdad all the way back to the governor's office. And he asked the guy, he said, did you write this article? Is this your article? Because your name? And the guy said, yeah. And he said, well, you called me. I am the representative of the wrestling. You're calling me a prostitute? You're saying I'm a whore? And he put the guy in, he put him in a cell for a while. And then I think he lost his job. He was teaching school out in some little one shack place out in the middle of nowhere.
Better to lose your job than your head, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know, Adnan, the whole time I was there, he looked like the poster boy for a walking nervous breakdown. Mm-hmm. He had a worry beads that he was playing with all the time.
Wow.
And I'd like to say I feel sorry for him, but being that he brought me over there, now he'd be everybody two straight falls, I believe. Maybe with Ian, I don't know the finish. I know he did Gordienko, I know he did Andre. Well, with me, he wanted me to beat him. In fact, when Raul Wisco first talked to me on the phone, he said, we want you to come over and beat him. And I said, all right, well, it's just pro wrestling. I said, well, I'll do the job or I'll beat him, whatever you want. I didn't understand what I was getting myself into. He said, well, I want you to know now, because he repeated this, I want you to know, we're bringing you over there to beat him. Because that way later, he could say, well, I warned you. But no, he didn't warn me. He said, we're going to have you beat him and risk your life and make yourself a potential victim to everybody in the country, the most hated man in the Middle East. So,
Bob, I don't want to sidetrack you, just a yes or no question real quick for you. Adnan, had you met him prior to this Iraq? Okay, I was just curious. I know you'll run into him later, but I was just curious if you had met him yet before this. Okay, continue, please.
Never heard of him before. Okay. I got there. You know, I was looking at a picture of me when we got there in the country. He and I were a picture taken together. And boy, body language just really, really tells. I was leaning away from him, you know, and I mean, I just met the guy. But I was leaning away from him, and I know what my body language, I know what that was telling me. I wasn't aware of doing it at the time. I'm leaning just perceptively, you know, a couple inches away from him rather than standing shoulder, because we're standing shoulder to shoulder.
Uh-huh.
And what I'm feeling from the guy is making me not want to be close to him. And I felt that way the whole time. And I should have. He knew how much danger he was putting me in, but rather me than him. What happened was that he had gotten so popular. I've said things like, as popular as the Beatles and Elvis Presley and put together. And I mean it, because everybody in the country adored the guy. He had the advertisement and all the roundabouts in Baghdad. They had a picture of him, but the picture was about as high as a telephone pole of him facing in his wrestling stance. They had a little picture of me. I come up to about his knee, up to his knee. But that's fine. I didn't expect him, but a big freak. But I mean, that guy, so everybody driving through Baghdad all day sees his picture up 7 or 8 times. So yeah, he was big. But like you say, if he's found out, plus the whole time he wants to leave, he's looking for some way to get out of there. Saddam told him, no, you're going to be our poster boy. Now here's the thing. It wasn't just wrestling. Wrestling was political. Wrestling, it was a political thing.
Right, yeah.
What happened? That's why there were 4 TV cameras there. The matches were going on all through the Middle East. And what that showed, a stadium was, like you said, an ocean of people. And the matches were promoted by the Ba'ath Party. And Saddam, and the president, Abubakar, and Saddam Hussein. The Ba'ath Party itself, when they took power, they only had about 1,000 members in their party, but with Saddam corralling, they promised all those political leaders they would have $10 million in a Swiss bank account the next day if they signed up. So they went along with it, but what they had to do was they didn't have much strength in terms of having manpower. If the military had somehow left them or departed, they would be out. And if they were out, like I said, when Saddam, his party took over, they basically sent a note to the president before them and said, we're going to be showing up at the presidential mansion about 10 o'clock tonight. Say it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right.
We're going to be showing up about 10 o'clock tonight. You know, if you're smart, you won't be there. If you aren't smart and you are there, we're going to bring you a present. We're bringing you a casket. So they gave the guy plenty of time. He got on a plane and got himself out to Paris in exile. And of course, he had his millions stashed away, so he lived. I'm sure he lived pretty well.
Right.
But they weren't going to do that. That guy was no threat to him. There was no way he was going to come back and take the government from Saddam. Saddam was did time in prison for an assassination attempt when he was 20 years old, for political assassination. He tried to assassinate one of the leaders at that time. And he went into exile in Egypt for a couple of years, was in prison for a while. So, I mean, they knew that he would do anything. If he lost power and was left alive, he'd do anything he could. If he got away to another country where he was in exile, he would be doing everything he could to try to get back in power. So someone like Saddam was one of the first people you're going to make sure was dead. You wanted him dead first, because he's the guy that controlled a lot of resistance to whatever you might be trying to do.
It took a while, yeah. But they finally got there with that.
Oh, yeah. Well, he killed 1 million people first.
Yeah.
When I went there, he'd only killed about 150.
Oh, only? Only?
Yeah. He only had a year and a half,
Okay. All right. I'm sorry I'm laughing at that. It's just to think about that,
Yeah. Well,
that's crazy.
Yeah. He provided a macabre entertainment, but also an object lesson. Early on in his regime of the Ba'ath Party, when he had the power, he brought up trumped up charges against 15 Iraqi. These are Iraqi citizens who happen to be of the Jewish faith. He said they were spies, and he hung them in the town square in Baghdad. And it was open. It was people were invited. They advertised it on the radio and on television in the movie theaters that they were going to be hung like a week later.
Wow.
And that people were invited to come. And they hung them and they left them hanging on these lampposts. And they said that in the, over the weekend, up to 500,000 people, you had to walk. You couldn't drive down there. The roads were too congested. But people, 500,000 people walked through the park looking at those bodies. Well, what Saddam did with that was he made it look like he was doing patriotic because they all hated Israel. They hated the Jewish nation. So it looked like he was doing, you know, these were spies, supposedly.
Right.
And the other thing was he scared the crap out of everybody because...
Yeah, that'll do it.
These people didn't have a trial. Or if they did, it was just a Saddam. Right. The way he got rid of enemies in the government, when he took over the government, he wanted only people from his tribe that were related in some way through blood or allegiance of some kind. So what he did, the people he wanted to get rid of, he pinpointed, and people were invited to denounce the person he had in mind. And if you did denounce him, you were going to be denounced. So he had a bunch of guys who, just to save their own bacon, would denounce another member of the legislature, whatever you call their government, or their council, let's say. I think there's a couple hundred. So he sent the guys who were denounced out into the hall under guard. And I think when there were 30 of them, they were denounced by 30 different people. The guys who had denounced them had to go out there and shoot them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So by that way, by having the guys who were the ones that denounced him shoot him, he owned them from then on, of course. And if there was any way that they were disloyal or whatever, then, of course, they were going to get shot, too. Yeah. What he did was he instituted a reign of terror. You know, you had to be real careful about what you said, what you did, your opinions. If somebody was heard knocking the governor, the president of Iraq, it was brought to the attention of the authorities. As soon as they found a person, they cut their tongue out on the spot and with a pair of pliers and a box cutter. And they actually showed them doing that on national TV. They also showed one where a former president had been in captivity for a long time. And they decided that his crimes had been so heinous that he needed to be executed. What they did is they put him in a room tied in a chair, and about 10 guys stood on one side of him with machine guns and fired until their guns were empty. They just made a hamburger out of the guy on national TV.
Wow.
Yeah.
I really didn't dive back into all the crazy stuff that went on. I mean, I remember growing up during, you know, Desert Storm and whatnot. So I remember all of that, but I just didn't really go deep into, you know, the man and some of the things that were going on over there. Just more so paying attention to the actual war we had at the time. I was thinking I was 11, 12, something like that. But yeah, it's crazy. Now you come over here and you walk into this guy's world, for better or worse, for worse, clearly. You have more than one match over here, correct or no?
I was scheduled for one match.
Okay, that's what I was getting at. Did you know you were going to have two matches?
No.
Okay.
I had a slate of things that I was supposed to do starting from the first day. The reason we went a week early before the match was I was going to make these promotional appearances. But you know what? I probably had all the tickets sold by that time. I mean, why do you need to promote something if all the tickets are already sold? So because of the fact that I was an American, America has so much heat over there. The reason why was in 1967, the Six-Day War, all the three countries surrounding Israel, Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, they all attacked at the same time. And it was supposed to be a sneak attack, but Israel had found out about it ahead of time. And as soon as the first tank from Egypt crossed the Suez Canal onto Iraqi soil, Israeli Air Force already had their planes up in the air, below radar. And they swooped into Syria and Egypt and Jordan and wiped out all the planes that were still on the ground in those countries. So they took away all their air cover. Basically, they lost those invading countries lost the war in the first hour of the war by having all their planes destroyed. Because if you, you know, if you were good at tanks, if you've got planes from the enemy can just firebomb your tanks at will, and you don't have any planes that can protect your own armament. So they took a week, but the Arab countries had to go to the UN and ask the UN if they would please ask Israel to quit kicking the crap out of them. And the United Nations did that. Well, you talk about being embarrassed. They had been beating their chest for once they made the attack. They didn't realize how bad it was the first day or two. They were patting their chest. We're going to get rid of the Jews once and for all. We'll throw them out of this part of the world. We'll kill them all. And then 5 days later, they have to abjectly beg for Israel to quit beating the crap out of them. Plus, they lost five of the surrounding areas that had been occupied by Arabic people, were now taken over. All the Arabs had been driven out by the Israeli army, and the West Bank, Suez Peninsula, and three or four more, I can't think of the names of all of them, but Israel gained, you know, just probably 30% more country for Israel, that now became Israel's land, than they had before. So it wasn't just a humiliating defeat. They lost face, they lost property. So who can they blame? They can't say, yeah, we screwed up. They can't do that because it's just, you know, I mean, that's just not done. So who do they blame? They blame the United States. They said the United States was to blame, that they somehow let Israel know. And Lyndon Johnson was the president. He stayed well away from it. He wouldn't want to have anything to do with it. And it made clear that they knew that he wasn't sending arms, he wasn't sending planes or armaments or bombs or anything. He didn't want to get the United States involved in a war in the Middle East. We had Vietnam already. We didn't need any more. So
now that was, yeah, the Six-Day War was 67, about 5 years before you went there. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And, well, by one of the reasons the Ba'ath Party took over was because of festering anger and humiliation from that defeat.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, and they blamed the United States, and that we were easy to blame. We're, you know, half a planet away. We're not there to, in any shape or form, to defend ourselves. There was no embassy. I found that out too when I got to
a little late to figure that one out.
Yeah, I said, yeah. Oh yeah, it was my fault. I asked Russ, let's go ask him. I'll be safe over there, right? No problem. He's, oh,
you
no,
mean,
no problem.
You mean you didn't Google it?
No, I didn't. Okay. Yeah, I'm curious. Anyway, that's nice to find out. Oh, where was I?
Well, I mean, you were telling us kind of the backstory of everything going on up until you got here, and now you're here, and we know they took your passport as soon as you got off the plane, basically. And
well,
you said you got there a week before the first originally only one scheduled contest. That was just, right, I guess, to promote everything.
Well, we were supposed to do something every day. We had an itinerary, but it never happened. We had to wait for somebody. You know, the British were guests there too. They were my contingent. They were with me, but we had to wait for the Iraqi people, the officials, to come and take us to these, which they did for Gordienko, for Andre. Andre, they took all over the country. They wanted him seen everywhere.
Yeah,
he went to parties.
Him off.
Oh, he went to parties every night. He had gifts. People gave him Rolex watches and, you know, saw solid gold cufflinks with diamonds in them. He was treated like, oh, yeah, he was. Yeah, no, I don't blame him. You know, how often do you get to see someone like that?
I'm telling you.
But I got none of that. So finally, after about 4 days, we're going to be welcomed by the governor. I think that was supposed to happen on the first day, but they delayed 4 days. And then finally we went to see the governor. And so I've been going out on my own by this time. I've had two Secret Service guys that anytime I went anywhere, I had to take these guys. They had to take me. We had a Mercedes of some kind, and I sat in the back and they sat in the front. But I went out and I did some videotaping, and fortunately my tape got lost or wasn't done very well. So after I think the fourth day, about two or three days till match time, I went to the governor's office, and we walk into this his building, and you know, it's a big official looking building. And we walk in, there's six officers, Army or military officers, waiting for us. And the Raw Wiscos walk me up to these officers and just keep going. And I said, they said, they'll bring you into the governor's office, Bob. And off they go. So these guys, I said, you know, oh, good morning. Nobody spoke to me. So this one guy, he had a riding crop, you know, like a, you know, hit a horse with. And that's what showed he was a leader. He turned and said, you know, and signaled, everybody turned, and I guess I was to follow him. So I did. We went down. We went through a door and went down a floor. We were on the ground floor, but we went down. So it'd be the first story, first floor underneath. There was, we looked into this big room, and there was a great big cell in there, a big jail cell. He probably had benches in it. You could probably put maybe 50 people in it. And there was a couple people in there just wretched looking. And then we went down to the next floor and went into a room similar to the one above. It had smaller cells. It had like 10 or 12 smaller cells. And they, about half of those were full. And everybody, I mean, you're talking about wretched, looked stinking. You could smell, you know, urine, feces, vomit, blood, you know, just horrible. And then we went down to the bottom floor, and I could tell because even the hallway, the rather than brick or mortar, there were hard dirt. You know, the soil was so, from all the heat, it was so hard. It was like, you know, you need a jackhammer to pierce it. So, and there was at the end of this hallway, there was a big door. And we walked up to the door, and these three guys, eight guys lined up, four on the side, knocked on the guy's swagger stick, knocked on the door with the swagger stick, tuck, 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 and this little porthole, like at a speakeasy, where they open the little door up at eye level and look through to see who's out there. It opened, and this guy looked like Shrek, looked out through it, and the officer in charge said something to him, and he pulled the door open and swung it inward. And was backed up, still looking at me all the time. He was looking at me like he wanted to bite my head off. He backed up, and the officer said, well, would you like to look over one of our facilities if you had the nerve? And I had to take his dare. I was seriously pissed off at these guys by that time, and they were so rude. And so, again, I don't realize what danger I'm in. I figured these guys were just rude. They were just anti-American. I didn't realize they could do whatever they wanted with me. I mean, I knew I still had to wrestle. So, I mean, obviously they can't just, but who knows? Maybe they could. I looked at every one of those guys. I looked them in the eye. I said, any one of you guys push your hand on this door when I go in there, I'm going to kick the shit out of you when I come out of here. So I went through the door. I walked in. I'm keeping my eye on that. This guy's a torturer. He's got an apron on, he's got blood all over, he's got it all over his arms and shoulders. And he's a typical, stereotypical. He's bald-headed, jug-eared, big, thick neck, big, fat body, sadistic. He looked like he had an IQ of about 20, just a nasty, had a sadistic grin on his face. And as soon as I got, like 5-6 feet into the torture chamber, I looked to the right and to the left. There are dirt walls on both sides. And they had holes dug in them that were like maybe 3 feet diameter and maybe 6 feet in length or maybe seven, I don't know. And that's where the prisoners were, the people waiting their turn to be tortured. They were crammed in these holes. A couple of them had their heads sticking out and looked at me like, please, can you, you know, I mean, the looks they gave me were just so pitiful. A bunch of them had their feet sticking out. And every one of the people that had their feet sticking out, their feet were hideously swollen. Apparently, some people took clubs and went by, and if their head was sticking out, I guess they bashed them in the head. If their feet were sticking out, they bashed their feet just to make sure they weren't back there sleeping or doing something positive. So the ogre looks over his shoulder and made a signal, and they dragged this poor guy in there and threw him down in front of us between me and him. This guy, they had burned him. He had an ear that was burned off. You could see the burned area around it with charcoal. And one of his eyes was missing. His teeth were gone. He had burn marks all over his body. And, he was conscious, but I couldn't look like to me. He was just barely alive. And the ogre looked at him and pointed at him and then looked at me, nodding his head, like what he was saying was, I'd like you to be like this guy. I'd love to get my hands on you because I would make you look like this guy. And so two of the stooges picked this guy up and they went to shove him in one of those holes, feet first, but he was so weak that one of his legs flopped out of their grip and was dangling down. They couldn't get him in the hole right away. The ogre looked over his shoulder and saw that, that there was a problem. So he reached over and he grabbed this poor guy. He grabbed one of his fingers and broke it. And that woke the guy up enough to, he screamed, it woke him up enough to pull his leg up where they could shove him in that hole. Well, about that time, I'm getting ready to back up and get out of there because what I'm doing is I'm giving an excuse to abuse these people even worse, for my benefit. So I figured I'd get out of there. I hear the door shut behind me. Well, I didn't take my eyes off the Shrek. I backed up, though, and I tested that door. I'm telling you, if that door had been locked, I have no doubt in my mind I could have knocked it off its hinges. The adrenaline buildup I had then. Mm-hmm. Or maybe I'd have taken Shrek and knocked it off the hinges of him. But I stood back through the doorway. And they saw the look on my face when I go through, and these eight officers are all smiling and saying things in Arabic to themselves, whatever language. They're saying things, and it's kind of sniggering and laughing at each other. So I said, I shouldn't cuss on the air here. Which one of you MFers, and I said it, which one of you MFers shut this door on me? Come out. And I had a sport coat on. I took my coat off and dropped it on the floor. Which one of you did it? Oh, well, they quit sniggering real quick. They got real serious. The guys were not big. They were all probably between 5'8 and 6 feet, maybe weighed 140, 150 pounds. There was no big muscular guy. But there were eight of them. And I meant it. I was, you talk about adrenaline flowing. It scared the crap out of me, but it enraged me too. I mean, what bestial, what kind of reception is that to bring someone to your country and show them that kind of crap? They refused to fight.
This is how you were publicizing the upcoming matchup, by the way, right? So,
Yeah. Those guys in the torture chamber were all going to be guests of honor at the match.
Apparently yeah. So. That's some messed up stuff right there, man.
Is it too grim?
No. I mean, I'm sure everybody out there is certainly engaged right now. I am. It's real life, man. It definitely gives you a view of what was going on. Only a firsthand experience could really recall such a thing. I mean, it's crazy. Knowing that this actually was a thing. This was actually happening. But
oh my God.
Yeah.
It would be such an immoral lapse on my part to make up something like that.
Impossible. Yeah, I'm just saying, yeah. It's just insane. But just hearing someone actually say it that actually saw it, it's another story rather than just reading it in a book. Well, Saddam did these things, it's crazy.
Well, I'm not asking anybody to feel sorry for me. I feel, but our hearts should all go out to these poor.
Yeah, certainly. Mine does right now.
Yeah, I'm poor sure people that found themselves in the way of these. Saddam was called the Butcher of Baghdad for good reason.
Right.
He did crap like that. Anyway, we had one more little stopover at the, we stopped at the War Museum on the way back up the stairs. I still hadn't gone in there to meet with the governor yet, which I'm not sure we might not get to that today, but we'll see. We stopped at the, they had a museum there from their wars. Most of what we saw in their military museum was war, their wars with the Israelis. The curator, or the guy who was a captain or something, he spoke English. And because he had to speak to me to explain what was going on in these wars or these battles. And so none of these other guys had spoken to me, except the one guy saying, you go in here. So to the guy that was major who was in the was a military guy in the museum. Well, anyway, he's showing me these battles, and every one of them, they lost. Every battle he showed me, the Iraqis or the Arabic side got their ass kicked by the Israelis. So I somehow just couldn't resist the chance to point that out. I said, well, you know, I'm curious why you would make replicas of all these battles. Were there any that you won? I said, why? You've lost them all. Why would you do that? Well, the major didn't want to talk to me much more after that. So we kept moving. We went around to, we went outside. The museum had a door that led outside. So we were a place behind this big building. And there was a wire fenced in stockade thing back there. And there was seven or eight vehicles back there. And they were really interesting because they had styles that went all the way back to cars that looked like back in the days of Al Capone on the streets of Chicago, those kind of cars, those sedans. And, you know, and the thing about them, every one of the cars was shot to hell, except one. There was one that again, one of these great big, probably cost $1 million when it was new. And all it had was didn't have a lot of machine gun bullets or bullet marks on it. It had a hole in the ceiling over the passenger area. The hole was about, 2 feet wide. And all the metal was pointing downward, like the explosion came from the outside and forced the metal downward. And I looked at that. And I tried to figure out what it could have caused that. And apparently, the only thing I could think of was that if they were stupid enough to be driving through the streets of Baghdad, maybe over a place where somebody could be standing on a balcony, and as they went by or as they paused below, dropping one of those anti-tank shells on the thing right on the roof, because anybody that was inside that thing would have turned into hamburger. They'd probably liquefy them. But every one of the vehicles was shot to pieces. And there was a couple of Mercedes Benz. And I asked I said, well, what are these? He said, these are the vehicles of past Iraqi presidents.
Oh, lots of assassinations then.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
I kept wanting to say, why do you keep this stuff? But anyway, finally we made it up to the governor's office. I walk in there and the English contingent, all four of them are sitting there looking just miserable. The governor's there. He's got about 12 guys behind him. They're a combination of military. He's sitting at a desk. They're standing like right next to him, as close to the desk. I mean, the ones on his immediate right and left would be almost pressing up against the desk itself. And then they just spread out to the side. There'd be like six guys on each side. Adnan Casey was immediately to the governor's right, and they're just sitting there waiting for me. So I came in, I looked over at the English people. You know, I was pissed, you know, because I figured they had to know what was waiting for me, because they wouldn't get kept, you know. It suddenly started to make sense why they'd been so aloof and distant since we, you know, got on the plane to get there. They knew what was waiting for me, or had an idea. Why wouldn't they warn me?
Yeah, this is definitely a long way from gifts, parties, and Rolex watches, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and none of them would make eye contact. And so I just walked up and looked at them. None of them would even look at me. I just snorted and turned around. I sat down. I leaned back like I'm getting ready to relax. And I opened up I had a sport coat on. I opened it up and let it relax, and I crossed my right leg over my left leg and just put my hands on my laps and twiddled my thumbs like I was bored. I looked around like, okay, where am I here? The governor's sitting about 10 feet in front of me. Now, the chair I'm sitting in is between, there's chairs about 10 feet behind me. There's big rows of them where like guests and press or whatever. This is the governor's office. He's sitting in front of a desk that probably cost 10 grand or whatever. And down at the other end of the room, there was a small library and some couple statues and stuff. But, you know, I'm facing the governor. And when I relaxed and put my leg up across the leg, Casey came running around the desk. He had to go all the way around the guy the farthest on his side. I probably wanted to jump over the desk, but he come running around, and came run up to me and says, leaned over and whispered in my ear, nobody crosses their legs in front of the governor unless he does it first. So, and they turned around and ran back, and I didn't move it right away. I waited till he got back. When he got back, he turned around and saw I still had my leg up there. He turned white. So I sat up a little bit, put my leg down and straighten my coat and set up. And the governor, you know, I'm thinking about it now. The governor might have been reacting to me, but, you know, he knew where I was then. He knew I'd been shown all the you know, the treats and all the good times that they were having downstairs. So, I didn't expect him. I thought he was the biggest asshole in the world. As far as I knew, I didn't know these guys were murderers and all that. I didn't know they were. I knew they were nasty, vile people. These, I mean, not Iraqi. Iraqi people, the whole, are very nice people. But these particular government people, what right. a bunch of assholes. They were, you know, what a jerk off. I met politicians in very high. I met royalty in foreign countries I worked on. And, they, you know, most of them are fairly decent people. You talk to them. Otherwise, they'd never want to even talk to a wrestler. You know, I thought this guy was just a mid-level bureaucrat. He was the governor of Baghdad. Okay, well, that's a big city. Yeah, okay, but you know, it's not. We're not talking about the president or the vice president of the country. He's a local authority, a local official. Found a way to look up what his background was. I knew he'd been educated in the West and he spoke English, but he conducted our whole interview. He spoke nothing but. I believe his language is Arabic, and he had a translator. So he spills off, he's glowering at me, just looking at me like, you know, I just, you know, kicked his wife in the nose. And he's looking at me, he says something to the translator. So his welcome question is, tell me why your country supplies our enemy with planes and bombs to kill and wound our women and children. And that was his hello welcome question. And I got pissed. What a jerk.
Was he expecting an answer, or was he being a smartass?
Well, he was trying to get me, and I believe me, it made me, because I realized this guy, he didn't care about me. He didn't have any at all. You know what I was starting to realize? They know that they had me, and I was starting to realize it too. This guy can say whatever. I can't say okay. I'm pissed off now. I'm not going to wrestle. I want a plane out of here tomorrow. I had kind of started to realize that maybe things were a little more sticky than that. I said, well, you know, I'm here as an athlete. And I tried to pass the buck. How am I going to get into politics with this guy? So I said, I'm here as an athlete. I said, just like at the 68 Olympics, when I met your athletes, Iraqi athletes, as well as Russian athletes of countries that are, you know, don't have diplomatic relations, the athletes all got together and everything was fine. Athletics transcends politics. And I'm not here as a representative. I'm proud to be. No, I'm not here politician. I'm here as an athlete. So he said, he spilled off to the translator again. He said, does that mean that you just go along with whatever your politicians decide to do, whether it's immoral and criminal, like helping kill our women and children? So I forgot about my position. When you get mad, you lose your intellect. And I said, well, all I can do in my country, the way that we do things is we have elections. People run for office. And my position, what I'm allowed to do is I'm allowed to vote for who I want. But here's the thing. If who I vote for isn't elected, all I can do is wait another, say for president, I can wait another 4 years for the next election. I get a chance to vote again, unless I decide to do something like, say, pick up a gun. And I leaned forward and I looked him right in the eye and I smiled at him. I decided to pick up a gun. And he knew what I was talking about. I had just seen the car park down there, the mortuary for wounded vehicles down there, because that's how That's I could have said it. We don't have elections like you guys do, you know, new government by machine gun. We have elections where people vote. But that's what I was saying. Oh, he got it too. He turned bright. He turned red to the beep. He was an intelligent man. He was an asshole, but he was intelligent. Things kind of went south from there. The interview didn't last much longer. I think back to that. You know, one thing I should mention, I had PTSD from that. The torture chamber was part of it. But from the whole affair, when you're alarmed and worried for your life, like, well, we haven't gotten to, let's go to the match.
Yeah, I don't know how you really transitioned from that situation to a wrestling match, but that's what you were forced to do, basically.
Yeah, there wasn't anything. Let me think. There wasn't anything of real import between then and the match. I wasn't invited to go anywhere.
Well, I was going to ask you, did you ever do anything? But clearly not really.
No, okay. I wasn't invited to go anywhere officially after that. You know, like I say, Andre and George and those guys, I don't know about the other guys, but, well, I know that Ian Campbell
went twice, I'm guessing that it turned out okay. Yeah.
I know he got a nice gift there. I can't remember what it was, but they gave George and Andre all kinds of gifts. The government did.
What turned them so nasty on you? Was it just you being an American?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I was trying to figure that out.
Well, let me tell you how I know that these guys had plans to do away with me. And the reason I know why, and the reason I know for sure, is because even though I didn't find out until 2015 that Saddam Hussein was the promoter, I never saw Saddam in person. I never saw the president of the country in person. And everybody that had been there before or had multiple visits with both men. Andre told me he'd met Saddam several times, and he had met the president twice. The fact that I never got to see any of them, even in private, see, they could have met me in private. Nobody in the country would have needed to know about it if they were worried about it being bad press.
Right.
But I think the reason, in fact, I'm sure, the reason they didn't want to have anything to do with me, Saddam didn't come to the matches. He'd been to all the ones before. He didn't go to that one. He did, but he was upstairs. He was upstairs in a stadium where he could see what was going on. But he didn't come out where he could be. I never saw him in, and I never saw the president. And I'm pretty sure that's so they could have deniability. They weren't after, especially.
That's also, I'm guessing, that really makes sense that why you weren't invited to parties and things as well. Because they didn't want to show any support towards the United States.
Right.
Okay. Well, everything makes a little more sense now to me. I guess I was just lost in all of these other stories that I really wasn't answering my own questions. But now it's starting to all come together. I see why they're doing what they're doing with you versus what they did with everyone else prior to you. None of them were Americans. Andre hadn't even been over here yet, or if he had, it wasn't very much.
Right. Well, without you finding out that when I heard Casey talk about Saddam being the promoter. It's like a great big stick of dynamite went up in my head, psychologically. And it's like I had 5,000 big pieces of puzzles running around in my head all those years. And when I saw one, Saddam to it, they all came together. And I saw the picture. I saw why I was treated that way. So we go to the matches. Now, here's the deal. Here's where Casey really... you know, we talked earlier about him being trapped there, and he was. But here's his problem. He had become so popular, like I say, the statue, the governor, or the president of the country, national television, adopted him, say, "You are now my son, Dad and I, Casey." Like, I mean, he didn't officially do it.
Right. I get what you're saying. Sure.
Symbolically.
Figuratively. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, what that does is
has set well with Saddam's ego.
Exactly. Not just that. If a rival faction approached Casey, I mean, Saddam bought up everybody.
Right.
He bought up all the generals to get them to attack him. So if another general comes up and gets Casey to go with their party, and then, you know, they take Casey somewhere and protect him where he can't be murdered, then all of a sudden... You got Ed and Casey talking about, yeah, that's Saddam's a bomb, and these new guys here are the good guys. They're the ones you should back. So Casey was really feeling the heat. He brought me over there to beat him. Again, a year before, 11 months or 13, he had heard Saddam say, if he hurts you at all, in any way, I'm going to fill him full of holes and send him back to France in a box. And that's from a country that didn't have a lot of heat with.
Right.
Now we're talking about an American. Not only do they want me to beat him, they want me to make him bleed like a stuck pig and beat him. Exactly everything that Saddam talked about shooting somebody for. And I'm going to do all of it, you know, not just one or two of them, all of them. So we had this, comes match day, and even in the dressing room, I could feel the vibes, the electricity in the air. It's open air stadium. I could feel it back in the dressing room, how much emotional expectation, anticipation, and hopes and dreams. This was a big deal. This is like a Muhammad Ali fight to them. But they didn't have anything else. They didn't have rock concerts. They didn't have anything. Their entertainment, they had some movies. That was about it. Half the movies were about prayers and the bazaars and the mosque and stuff. Not anything. You know, they might show a movie here and there, but they had very little entertainment. So the wrestling was a big, big deal. Well, I put it this way. I went to a soccer match when I was there. They were having a soccer match, the national team of Iraq against the national team of Egypt. Now, these are World Cup teams. The stadium was about a quarter fill, the soccer stadium. We had 10,000 people there. 4 days later, we had the wrestling again. And it's, if you're looking down from above, you can't see any concrete or any field. The only place you can see any open
that's
area.
That's a fact.
Yeah, you can't see anything. You can't. So anyway, it was a big deal. And I could feel all that energy. Well, Casey was in the other side of the stadium in his own dressing room. So Rawisco was doing the message guide back and forth. He comes in, he hands me a blade. It looks like you could skin a beaver with it, you know. And he said, Adnan wants you to cut him. And I said, well, I said, hold on, down, he can go against himself. Get the thing away from me. I don't forget that. And so. So
you already kind of had a feeling of what not to do out there, huh?
Well, I didn't know anything about Saddam Hussein, but I just knew the ambiance I felt by that crowd.
Right.
Was already, I mean, all I needed to do was, I wasn't planning on doing anything heelish. I wasn't going to punch him.
You were out going out there to wrestle. I got you.
I was just going to wrestle. Yeah. And so, but they, you know, they told me, we're going to have you beat him. So what they wanted to do was they wanted us to go about 18 and a half minutes and have me, I was just going to catch him with like a small package or something like that for 1, 2, 3. And then in the second ball, they wanted me to cut him. They wanted me to cut his eyebrow open. And we'd go through the second fall, and then we'd go through the third fall. We'd wrestle the whole 20 minutes. If they had to stop for blood, now, if I was going to cut him, I wasn't going to under any circumstances, but say they had my mother in a cell and she was going to be blowtorched if I didn't do it, then okay, I wasn't going to cut, any stitches into him, you know, few scratches, maybe that's it. So, anyway, Rawisco went back.
I didn't mean to cut you off, Bob, but you guys, I'm assuming, never at any point had any opportunity to speak to one another while you were in Iraq. You and Adnan, I mean, because I'm assuming that would have given away the, you know, that yeah. This is a work.
I think it did in a way, but Adnan and Gordanko and Adnan and Andre. They walked down streets together advertising the match.
Okay. So it was more of a competition type deal with them. Okay.
Yeah, they shook hands before. It was like amateur wrestling, you know? Like I say, the rules were.
It wasn't
like
a heel and a face. I got you. But in this instance, it's a little different.
Well, under Commonwealth rules, no punching, no hitting, certainly no messing with the referee at all.
Right.
You can touch the referee, you get disqualified from the match. So the rules are a lot different. Now, you could do forearm blows and. You can't do that in amateurs, but it was a lot more amateur than anything pro wrestling in this country is. Well, finally, the fans were already late. Match was supposed to start 15 minutes ago, And there's nothing. There's no preliminaries. There's no preliminary earlier matches. It's just us.
Yeah, you're the one and only main attraction, yeah, you guys.
That's it.
Yeah, that's right. Let me, before we get to the big matchup here, I have a couple of good questions for you. I mean, they're decent questions. I was going to ask you to close out this. I won't call them great. But
no, anyway. Any question you asked is a good question, Ray.
So I got to ask you, this is not the United States. It's not Canada. It's not Europe. It's not Australia. This is Iraq. They have maybe one match a year on average. So what was the ring like in Iraq? Like, was it like a boxing ring, or was it just like hard as a rock crate? how was that set up? Like, how did that feel getting in there? And obviously you're outside too, the weather.
Well, it was February. And so it was a winter there. So it wasn't especially hot.
Okay.
Thank goodness. We did sweat, but not terribly. I mean, it wasn't humid either. Now, we were about 12 miles from the edge of the Sahara Desert, but it wasn't bad. Wasn't bad. I was in good shape.
So, but was the ring?
As far as seeing, the ring was a boxing ring.
Okay.
But again, we didn't do slam. I know, like, wrestling three times. We never slammed him. We did a lot of amateur wrestling stuff and grabbing holds. Maybe a hip toss, but more, instead of a hip toss,
lots
it'd be like more like a lateral drop.
Right, I gotcha.
So
kind of just a hip throw, a takeover type deal. Yeah, I gotcha.
Yeah, where there were no big bumps. Having a ring that was solid footing was actually better for that sort of thing. They had a pad. I remember the ring. I didn't get hurt from the ring.
Okay. Walking into the first match, which was supposed to be your only match, was it supposed to go all three falls? I don't remember how you said that was laid out. Like, how were the falls supposed to go? And then, we'll get to the other stuff here in a little bit.
Three 20-minute falls. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to go 18 minutes in the first one, and I beat him between 18 and 19 minutes. Somewhere I beat him with just a, quick catch, not...
Sure.
It was certainly not where he couldn't get up, about 10 count. Or I couldn't even hold him. He kicked out on about 3.5. And then we were going to go through the second 20-minute period.
Okay,
we were going to go 20 minutes, but
halfway
between it, we were both bleeding. And then the third fall, we were going again 20 minutes through. So we wrestled about 58 and a half minutes. Well, the thing is, like I said earlier, you had to win two falls to win the match.
Oh, okay. So it would have just
been
a draw.
So I didn't win the match, but he didn't beat me either. And I won the only fall. That was as much risk as he was willing to take to keep Saddam from using the pistol on him. But the same token, it put a ton of heat on me.
Well, since Saddam assumed this was real, this wrestling was an actual contest, I'm assuming Adnan was the one that basically booked the finish for this match. This would have been his idea. And his idea was to go to a straight draw with you rather than just go over like he had with everyone else?
Yeah, he wanted. I told you about that stature he had developed, where he was looking like the greatest thing since.
Oh, so he was trying to knock himself down a peg.
Yes.
Okay.
He wanted to diminish his luster a little bit.
Ah.
So
that
he wasn't quite so popular, but he didn't realize that all the luster he lost turned into heat that went on me. Especially the idea that we should save the particulars for next time, because the bloodletting that went on would have disgusted a butcher.
Okay.
As much as got slung around the ring.
So much
so
left.
Let's save that.
Absolutely.
Save that for next time.
Sounds great, because there's so much left to unpack. Kind of go into some of the details here in match number one, but specifically everything that happens afterwards. You should have been going home, but instead you're basically forced to stick around for a second event so that Adnan can get his heat back, whether he wants to or not. And then, after that, we get to tell the story of how the hell you even got the hell out of there and escaped the country and got back here to the United States to tell the story today. And, of course, all the fallout from that, the PTSD you've talked about in the past as well from that. It's crazy to think, just what you've told so far, not counting. And in between, you have to wrestle two matches. I don't even know if my head could even be in those particular times in the country. But it's just crazy. So much left to unpack, so much left to discuss. The best is yet to come, I guess you could say. What a near 2-hour trip this week. Just amazing that you can turn a 2-week trip into a hell of a lot of story here. It's amazing that you're here to tell the story, really, to me. Thank God for that.
I'm lucky. Yes, I'm lucky.
To say the least, you know, and I look forward to hearing the rest of the story, as I'm sure everyone is out there. We talked about you getting over there, how you got there, some of the people you came in contact with, and everything that led up to that first match. But really, this is really where the story gets good. And, you know, it's the art of the great storyteller, leave you wanting more. And that's what you've done here this week is, when we get back, Bob, we're gonna really unload with some good stuff.
Yeah, I don't think our listeners are ready for 3 or 4 hour podcasts. So, yeah, we got to hold it to a couple of hours. But, well, thank you, Ray. You know, I was kind of doubting that we could get the whole Iraq story told in one session because there's just so much.
Right.
There's so many nuances. Casey was hiding things. Saddam was hiding things. Everybody was hiding things except me. And
you didn't really have much of an option.
I was walking around going, huh? What? Huh? What? What do you mean? What are you doing? What? Why are you aiming that at me?
Yeah, I'm sure everybody looking forward to hearing about the actual wrestling matches, but also everything that happens in between and your voyage out of there. So looking forward to continuing the story next week here on the show. But want to thank you again, man, for another entertaining time. Just another day in the life or week in the life of Bob Roop. Just a totally natural thing that happens to everyone.
Well, you know what? Think about this, Ray. I couldn't do it without you, my friend. So you're just as necessary for this as I am. And also all the great research you do, and you have you have questions, and you've done your homework so that when I get lost, you can just turn me back, put me right back on the path, and I think maybe get somewhere close to where I started out aiming for. So thank you, my friend. Oh, you do a great job.
I don't have too much of a firsthand experience of being in Iraq, so.
But you haven't missed. Don't get me wrong. The Iraqi people are very, just like anywhere. There's good people everywhere.
Sure, but there's bad people, too.
When you have these totalitarian dictatorship governments, fascists, doesn't matter what kind of people there are, they're in thrall. You know, they're being controlled. They lose their rights. So
no, that's what it comes down to. But I'm not willing to take that risk of running into those people.
So no,
I'll just stay here.
Yeah, I'm loath to go to the middle of the country, much less the Middle East.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, Bob, that's gonna wrap it up here this week. Want to thank you again for taking some time out, and we'll continue this story of your time in Iraq next time on the show.
All right, Ray. Thank you, my friend. I appreciate it.
And all right, guys, that'll wrap it up here this week. Thank you, Bob, again so very much for all the great stories here. And a reminder that you guys can friend Bob over at facebook.com/poorbobroop. And you can find me, Ray Russell, over on X, formerly Twitter, at Rass and Grenade. That's at RASSLIN Grenade. Also, follow and like me, facebook.com/Rass and Grenade. Check out all of the wonderful shows as part of the WrestleCopia brand. You can do so by heading over to WrestleCopia.com. And of course, be sure to check out that $5 all access tier over at patreon.com/WrestleCopia. That address again, patreon.com/WrestleCopia. So many gifts, guys, for just $5, and every penny of it going right back here into the podcast network. So please show your support. Help keep all of the great shows here, like this one, up and running. We greatly appreciate each and every one of the listeners. And we'll be back soon with another edition of The Wrestling Stoop with Bob Roop.